Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on the programme...
What can cities do both to adapt to those changes and build resiliency, but also what can we do to get out ahead of it? What can we do in cities to tackle this challenge and tackle the adaptation to the changes that we know are coming?
Cities are some of the world's biggest polluters, so how should we be reimagining urban living to better tackle climate change? This week, we bring you a special report from the Cities and Climate Change Science Conference in Edmonton, Canada, where we met with scientists, global leaders, and policymakers who are trying to make city living greener. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes here on The Urbanist with me, Tom Edwards. This week's episode of The Urbanist is all about how to tackle climate change in our cities. Currently, more than half of the global population live in cities, which produce about 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. This means cities are in urgent need of a redesign to help make for a more sustainable future. So what's being done and what policies are being implemented to move from grey to green infrastructure? Yesterday, the inaugural Cities and Climate Change Science Conference wrapped up in Edmonton, Canada. It brought together over 750 NGO leaders, policymakers, city officials, and some of the world's leading climate change scientists in the Alberta capital for 4 days. The first of its kind, the main objective behind the conference was vertical integration planning for cities to bring all these parties together to combat climate change with a bottom-up approach. Monocle's contributing editor, Sheena Roster, was at the event, and she tells us how cities around the world are the main battleground for climate change.
On a snowy but sunny March day in Edmonton, hundreds of the world's leaders in climate change research have gathered, all with the same objective in mind, to define the global research agenda for cities and climate change for the decade to come. An agenda that will look to prevent the worst possible impacts of climate change. Fossil fuel-dependent economic growth is coming to an end, but cities around the world are still dependent on fossil fuels in order to function. That means a lot of things. Transport and housing systems need to be looked at and repurposed to make for more sustainable cities. And here are some of those questions that delegates here at the city's IPCC Cities and Climate Change Science Conference are working hard to answer.
What can cities do both to adapt to those changes and build resiliency, but also what can we do to get out ahead of it? How can we accelerate reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in cities where 70% of the world's emissions come from? What can we do in cities to tackle this challenge and tackle the adaptation to the changes that we know are coming?
That's Don Iveson, the mayor of Edmonton. This conference being hosted in Edmonton, Canada's youngest major city, was his idea. After attending the United Nations Marrakesh Climate Change Conference, better known as COP22, back in 2016, he pushed for his city to host the inaugural event. We'll hear more from Mayor Iveson a little bit later in our program. But first, let's rewind and take a look at some of the big steps that have been taken to combat climate change in recent years.
L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
At the 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris, or COP21 as it's more commonly known, governments from close to 200 countries agreed on measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions after nearly 2 decades of trying. Among the objectives outlined in the landmark agreement, some of the goals are a long-term commitment to bring global carbon emissions down to zero, have a temperature target of no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, and for all nations to manage the impact of climate change.
I was quite relieved that at last governments managed to reach an agreement that would be universal, not just the restriction to the developed countries like for the Kyoto Protocol, but something that had universal value.
That's one of the world's leading climate change scientists, Valérie Masson-Delmont. She was at COP21 in Paris when the agreement was being finalized in 2015.
What I liked in the agreement is that it was very lucid, recognizing that the pledges from the governments at the time of COP21 were not sufficient to actually reach the long-term target, which is to stabilize global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. So I liked the sort of evidence-based approach of the agreement.
Although not perfect, the Paris Agreement has been viewed as historical and applauded not only by climate change scientists like Valerie Masson-Delmont, but also by world leaders, including former U.S. President Barack Obama.
In my first inaugural address, I committed this country to the tireless task of combating climate change and protecting this planet for future generations. 2 weeks ago in Paris, I said before the world that we needed a strong global agreement to accomplish this goal, an enduring agreement that reduces global carbon pollution and sets the world on a course to a low-carbon future. A few hours ago, we succeeded.
After arriving back in the United States from Paris, President Obama acknowledged the global unity behind the agreement.
I also want to thank the people of nearly 200 nations, large and small, developed and developing, for working together to confront a threat to the people of all nations. Together, we've shown what's possible when the world stands as one.
But not long after President Obama left the Oval Office, and less than 6 months after President Donald Trump was inaugurated in January 2017, the United States had a shift in policy on climate change.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
To some leading the battle on climate change, the United States' withdrawal from the agreement comes as a surprise. Here's Valerie Masson-Delmont again.
After that agreement was signed, I was also aware that there would be counter-reactions, because going to a carbon-neutral development path is, of course, something that goes against short-term or specific private interests. I was surprised it came from the US. Because North America has often showed a way where science and technology and innovation were used together to improve well-being with a clear vision of progress. So for me, it was also a quite sad surprise that the strongest counter-reaction would come from North America and the U.S. specifically.
There was surprise stateside, too, with President Trump's announcement to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. His words rang hollow with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, a supporter of the Paris Agreement, and who was in attendance at the Cities and Climate Change event in Edmonton this week.
There were two things that really upset me about the president's statement. Number one is the amount of work that went into that over the course of 20 years in order to be able to get to the point where the entire world was a part of crafting a decision that would affect the entire world. And number two was he played upon an image of Pittsburgh's past in order to be able to try and make that statement, which was completely unfair to the sacrifices that people in Pittsburgh made over 30 years to change into a green economy. So when he brought that up, it offended me on both of those levels. On the sacrifices that the entire world made in order to be able to realize that we could get to a solution, in the United States being the only country to abdicate from its responsibility. And number two, in using Pittsburgh as his example, and not Pittsburgh of today, but a Pittsburgh in the past that we're proud of, but that we worked very, very hard to change.
What is the Pittsburgh of today for people who don't know?
Pittsburgh of today is the home of Uber and Google, of Intel, Microsoft, Disney, Apple, Oculus, Tata, Bosch, companies from around the world that have come to Pittsburgh to create a global innovation center. Pittsburgh of today is one of the leading cities of finance, of medicine, technology, and healthcare. It is a diversified economy that has traveled further than any other city in cleaning our air and cleaning our water, but still has so much further to go. Pittsburgh of today is a green city with one of the largest urban canopies of an urban forest in the United States per mile. And it's a city where the people look back of the past that built this country with great pride and understand that the best days are still ahead.
America's so-called steel city is making a comeback with a diversified economy after the collapse of the steel industry in the 1980s created lots of unemployment. And the city has certainly flipped the script when it comes to sustainability goals with an ambitious 150-0 plan. 100% renewable city operations, 50% reduction in energy, and zero waste all by 2030. Getting there, though, doesn't come without challenges, as Mayor Perduto points out.
One of the challenges is, will we have a willing federal and state government in order to be our partners in being able to get there, or will it be more of playing defense in order to be able to go against where the incentives are being provided in order to do it? Regardless, we're committed to it. We'll partner with our other cities throughout the country and our other cities throughout the world. This is not a partisan issue when it comes down to cities. Mayors, both Democratic and Republican in the United States, understand the challenges and understand the potential damages from climate change, and we really have no choice but to address it.
North of the U.S. border, in Canada, Edmonton, the host of the IPCC Cities and Climate Change Science Conference, is the country's sixth largest city. And it's in the midst of an image revamp, too.
In 2013, Alberta provided almost every new job in the country. But as oil prices dropped almost 60% in the last 2 years, 40,000 people were fired from the industry.
Edmonton's economy has been in a bit of a downturn with low oil prices in recent years. But despite this, the Alberta capital is the fastest-growing city in Canada. Its projected population is 2.2 million in the city's metropolitan region by 2044. That's an increase of a million people over a 25-year period, up from the current 1.3 million people that call the Greater Edmonton area home. It's a city that has traditionally been the jumping-off point to the Alberta oil sands in the northern part of the province. So hosting a global environmental science conference in the city is really making a statement that times are changing.
First and foremost, the focus is on science with...
Remember Edmonton's mayor, Don Iveson? We already mentioned how he pushed for this conference to be here in the city. He tells us how the city is looking to shift its economy to go more green.
Well, we know there's going to be demand for fossil fuels for at least a generation to come as we move through a transition to lower carbon forms of energy and renewable forms of energy. So it's going to continue to be a part of our economy. The question is, how can we transition everything that we've learned about advanced manufacturing, everything that we've learned about chemistry and refining into the renewable fuels industry? The investments required are going to create new markets for new technologies and new opportunity. And all of that research, all of that innovation, all of that adaptation, all of that resiliency, that's going to actually occur at the hands of local governments in partnership with community. And so we have an indispensable role, and we can't come and go from the consensus. We're embedded within it.
What are some of the moves that we're making here in the city in order to diversify the economy to be less dependent on fossil fuels?
We produce commodities here that right now people primarily burn. Those commodities are going to be just as valuable and as important as pulp and paper and wood and food and other things that we produce here. So we have lots of different industries in place today, and what we want to do is move up the value chain on them and also continue to grow our strength in health and life sciences. We have one of the top artificial intelligence schools on the planet here, and so we see opportunities for technology to be applied across all of those traditional industries to reduce their carbon footprint, reduce their cost, increase their productivity, and create new solutions, new intellectual property that can be exported to solve climate challenges and food challenges and other challenges all around the world. So we're problem solvers here primarily, and we're going to apply our problem-solving skills.
At just 38 years old, Don Iveson is a young mayor, and he is part of the future generation that needs Edmonton to be more sustainable. But despite his age, he doesn't lack the experience. He's already in his second term as mayor, a post that he's held since 2013. Before that, Mayor Iveson was a city councillor for two terms. And with a focus on the city for over a decade, sustainable infrastructure is already being implemented.
The city is pursuing a green power purchase, the rollout of district energy systems with combined heat and power and renewable energy sources. We're building a neighborhood for 30,000 people next to our Polytechnic Institution, which will be a carbon neutral neighborhood with the first construction of houses happening this year. So we're doing tangible things now. We're also buying our first electric buses. We're doubling the size of our light rail system to give people more transportation options to support denser transit-oriented development, which we know is not only more walkable, but also lower carbon lifestyle. So we're making across-the-board changes to how we use energy and the shape and feel of our city and how people move around it, all of which will move us towards our long-term GHG goals.
Friends, I believe that change has finally come to Alberta.
It's not just the city of Edmonton that's taking bold steps towards fighting climate change. The Canadian province, Alberta, has taken aggressive measures in cutting down its greenhouse gas emissions by increasing penalties for CO2 emitters, and all of that was rolled out before the Paris Climate Change Conference in 2015. In all, the Canadian province pollutes more than any other. And it's been famous for its high-polluting industries, such as oil and gas. These carbon taxes are seen as groundbreaking. And they've been praised by members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Here's the IPCC chair, Huisong Li.
Alberta is the leader of taking action in climate change issues. That is quite a remarkable feature that other countries, other regional governments may also take into consideration when they develop their policies.
Is that surprising because Alberta was so dependent on fossil fuels for so long to generate their economy?
You know, that's one of the key elements also.
In what ways is Alberta a leader? And is it a leader internationally or just nationally?
Both, more than ever before. The roles and activities performed by the regional government, city governments, have become quite important in terms of addressing the climate change problems, because the actions are at the city level. For the climate change issues to get resolved, bottom-up process is very, very important. So the city holds the key. Regional government really will play a very, very important role, in addition to the roles that need to be played by the national government.
Alberta is also an interesting case study that saw a dramatic shift in policy after the political pendulum swung from right to left and ushered in the more left-leaning New Democrat Party government, or the NDP as it's more commonly known, back in 2015. And there is some concern that governments on all levels around the world tend to think more in terms of 3 to 4 year election cycles. There are fears that combating the effects of climate change might not always be in line with the interests and policies of political parties in charge. And some nations have passed laws to ensure environmental interests outlast political interests. In the UK Parliament, laws have been passed to assure work done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions stand the test of time. Jim Ski, a co-chair of the IPCC and professor of sustainable energy at Imperial College London, explains more.
I'm on the UK's Committee on Climate Change that produces all the recommendations for government. And that is really full on the science policy interface, because I've been on it for about 10 years now, and I have learned how to tailor your messages and get a narrative out in a way that can actually make a difference. You can be picked up on the policy making side. And I think the big lesson from the private sector is, as scientists, you tend to think in the very long term, the year 2100, you know, all these long term temperatures targets. That is not what drives a private investor, which is maybe Monday morning's a good kind of time horizon to be thinking about. The bigger companies will have investment cycles that run for 20 or 25 years. So that is the meaningful kind of time horizon to look at. And it's one of the reasons, actually, in the next IPCC report from Working Group 3, we've chopped the future into two different timescales. We do need to look at the year 2100, because that's what the long-term temperature target in the Paris Agreement refers to, really. But on the other hand, we have another much more short to medium-term chapter, which is much more targeted about the actions that can be taken now to make a difference and set you on the right path.
That's interesting that you say that, because obviously a lot of politicians just think in their four-year cycles of one, and even in the four-year cycles, they're really more thinking of a two-year cycle because then they're thinking about their re-election. So how does that work with the mayors that we are meeting here and the integration with bringing down carbon emissions in cities?
Well, let me say, first of all, how we've done with that issue in the UK, because we've got our Climate Change Act in the UK, which sets a legally binding target for the year 2050. And at any one time, you've got to have a set of five-year carbon budgets, and you've got to have three of them end-to-end that go 15 years in the future, that effectively locks in politicians in future parliaments and sets you on the right path. And it was the courage of the parliament that passed that Climate Change Act in 2008 to put in place a framework that sort of locks you in to a long-term decarbonisation path. And I think it's quite interesting that we had a presentation from Vice Mayor Berg from Oslo this morning at the conference, where Oslo has quite frankly cribbed a little bit from the UK climate change framework, used the concept of a climate budget, which you adhere to try and lock in and keep that long-term decarbonisation pathway in. Because in a way, that's the fundamental problem. How do you keep politicians honest, quite frankly, over decades when they're going to be elected every 5 years or so? And that's why I think some of these interesting legal frameworks are beginning to come through.
Now, we've looked at the challenges that are being implemented in the global north when it comes to climate change, but how different is the reality for cities in the global south? Financing for a more green infrastructure is a huge issue, and equal financing was laid out in the Paris Agreement in order to help developing nations. But as Deputy Mayor of Quito, Ecuador, Veronica Arias explains, more can be done.
We are certainly focused on providing basic services to the people, but this type of research or the effects can be multimillionaire, so we don't have to finance that. And the access for financial aid or financial funds from abroad or internationally, it goes through the national governments. That's why we have to talk with them. And if they are from the different political parties, the cities will not get the finance.
Interesting that you say that, because China is actually investing a lot in Latin America, especially in Ecuador, including building a bridge over there. So how much does international investment, namely from a new superpower, China, helping Quito become a greener city?
We do have some relations with China, but not necessarily our big funders. We do have more relation with multilaterals like IDB, the World Bank, the CAF. So bilaterals, financials could be helpful, but always it has to be done through the government, national government. That's why it's very important the vertical integration and conversations and dialogue with the national government.
Crippling corruption is also an issue. Here's Veronica Arias again.
Corruption is a big issue in Ecuador and Latin American countries. The metro line right now that is being built in Quito is being built by Odebrecht, but right now it's another enterprise, which is Acciona. Odebrecht is involved in corruption. The metro line in Quito that has been under a lot of ice, it has been clean until now, so we are doing the metro and we are building the metro at the city.
Another major issue for cities in the global south when it comes to combating climate change, be it in South America, Asia, or Africa, are slums and informal settlements. These communities tend to emit more greenhouse gas emissions than neighborhoods that are formally planned. Director of City Alliances, William Cobbert, explains more.
We work typically in small and medium-sized cities that are rapidly urbanizing. The challenge there is much less one of mitigation and one much more of adaptation, which is how to react to risks and threats. And so focusing on the long-term planning and the governance of the city amounts to the same set of challenges that you would have to address in order to respond to climate change. Let me give you a very practical example, which is in land use planning. under current conditions, the way in which land is not provided, not planned for, and not allocated means that we end up with spatial forms that are terribly inefficient and wasteful. So that does contribute to overall wasteful use of resources. But above all else, it means that through the lack of planning and very often quite a robust anti-poor attitude, it means that large populations end up on the most exposed land, floodable, landslides next to transport networks. This is not how you plan a city. City mayors, city managers have to adopt a city-wide approach. So you've got to look at the city in its entirety. You can't projectize it and then ignore half of it. You should do future planning, but it's the dull stuff that works. Good governance, strong institutions, the impartial application of the rule of law so that everyone's on the same turf, good administration, and equity. At the moment, where public authorities fail, normally the people who get penalized the most are the poor. So where you end up with the parallel markets that I was talking about, then I can give you a guarantee without even looking at the figures that the poor will pay more per liter of water, more per square meter of land, more for everything. That's not an equitable basis or a just basis for running a city. I think we know what makes for successful cities, but it does require a combination of political leadership, consistent behavior over time, and institutions. It works.
In the coming days, a declaration on the research and agenda that have come out of this meeting in Edmonton will be announced. That will be the talking points on cities and climate change at meetings in Montreal and San Francisco, which will take place over the next 6 months. But the real continued conversation that is coming out of this inaugural conference is the innovation of how scientific research can be used when city makers, policy makers, and scientists are all put in the same room. With a bottom-up approach, the conversations of cities tackling climate change is likely to be the big focus moving forward, as policymakers and scientists alike seek to find solutions to tackle what's said to be this generation's greatest problem. For Monocle, in Edmonton, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thanks, Sheena. Our contributing editor, Sheena Rossiter, there with a special report on the fight against climate change and the main takeaways from the first Cities and Climate Change Science Conference in Canada. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Anna Sinfield and David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Sean Paul with Temperature. Thanks for listening, city lovers. I got the right temperature for shelter you from the storm. Hold on, girl, I got the right tactics to turn you on. And girl, I wanna be the papa, you can be the mom. Oh, oh, because the girl them broke out from the floor from your door.